Talk given Sunday, 10th February, 1980. I thought it might be useful if today we considered together very carefully and necessarily briefly a very important question. And that is, what is the trend of life in us? Because if we understand that, we can see the purposiveness in our own personal existence. And also for mankind as a whole. The purposiveness of our own existence derives, of course, from the purposiveness for mankind. The animal kingdom is a vast kingdom composed of many different species, of which we are supposed to be the crown. And each species manifests a particular aspect of life in excelsis. There are so many things which we can't do, but the animals can. But there are things which we can do which the animals cannot and will not ever do, unless and until their actual constitution undergoes great change. I say this because function and structure are intimately interrelated. So now, let us look at mankind. Man is a creature in whom there is this extraordinary potentiality of self-awareness. And self-awareness is much profounder than just self-consciousness, because self-consciousness, with the vast majority through the ages, has been of an isolative nature and still is, and as such it is the source of conflict and disharmony both within ourselves, with our neighbor, and with the world as a whole, with life as a whole. But self-awareness, in the profound sense, means that we have emerged out of the restrictions imposed upon us by isolative self-consciousness. And therefore we can see the direction in which we are moving, and that would enable us to learn how to live cooperatively and not in conflict. We cannot live cooperatively as long as we identify ourselves with a limited aspect of human life. Practically everybody does that, because every person has his or her own specialized interest, and so he identifies himself with that interest and with the people who are similarly interested. This, of course, is unavoidable in the early stages. But by identifying oneself with a particular group, one has excluded all others. Or sometimes a person identifies himself with his own group, upholding his own special interest, as well as a few other allied interests. But all such identification means that one separates oneself from the remainder. And that drags in the problem of comparison and criticism. Those people live thus and behave thus. They are bad, they are evil. We, of course, don't do that. What we do is good. And sometimes we are so good that we become the chosen people of God Almighty, and so forth. So we have to watch this tendency to identify ourselves with something particular to the exclusion of the remainder. If we can free ourselves from such identification, then the true purpose for mankind as a whole becomes clearer. And when we see that, really see it, and let be the life force to work itself through each one of us in its own unique way, then our uniqueness emerges out of that. And therefore, we are totally ourselves, a unique manifestation of the whole, the totality, and at the same time we are completely at one with that totality. There is no conflict with it. So let us look at man. Self-awareness in this non-isolative sense. And the real self-awareness, therefore, is an unself-awareness. It's rather difficult to put it into words. But in the true self-awareness, one is aware of anybody and everybody around one or distant from one as part and parcel of one mankind. Then those words which are repeated so often, all life is one, becomes a reality, becomes a fact, instead of being just so many words which by themselves are impotent to bring about true harmony in life. What is it that distinguishes man from other creatures? Man is a psychophysical being. He has a divinely creative potentiality within him. The potentiality which is named mind. You find in all the great religions of the world, in the scriptures, texts which bear this out. Man is transcendence thinking, the thought in the mind of God. This is how it has been put in all the scriptures which have a theistic tendency. And because we function self-consciously and isolatively and not in terms of true self-awareness, we transplant our definition of thinking and thought onto the transcendent. Now this is a profound error. Thought in its reality is a creative energy. It is that creative energy, mind if you like, instead of thought, is that creative energy which brings forth cosmos, maintains cosmos. And therefore, in this cosmos, where all living things are concerned, the purpose of that particular species becomes apparent. It manifests in us whilst we are merely self-conscious in terms of our different psychical states, our different qualities, our virtues and vices as we call them. But as you all know, that is all contained within the state of duality, and it is contained in the sense of constriction. It is boxed in, as one may say. It is not free, and therefore mind as the creative energy cannot function through us freely. Now, in man lies the greatest possibility for allowing, enabling this potentiality, which is mind, this creative energy, to function freely through us, unresisting, unresisted by us. The psyche as it is offers plenty of obstruction to this. And in offering that obstruction, it perpetuates the isolativeness of self-consciousness and prevents self-awareness from coming into its own in us and in our lives. So of course we come back to the great teachings everywhere, the indispensability of the sīlas and the living of the good life, to use the Buddha's phrase, good conduct in thought, speech and action. And you find the same in Zarathustrianism, for instance. It's summed up there as good thought, good word, good deed. You find it in all the religious teachings, and in teachings which do not specifically go under the name of religion, such as yoga, term like yoga, there too the basis is the living of the pure life. Krishnamurti uses the phrase the preparation of the soil. It's a very interesting way of putting it. This soil is our own psychophysical organism, the preparation of it, in order to freely receive this transcendent energy, so that it can function through us without being resisted by us. Not that we consciously resist it. If we are at all religiously inclined, if we are at all awake, even to a small degree, of the fact that religiousness, which is one of our outstanding characteristics, hidden of course, not very obvious in the world, if we allow this religiousness to come to fruition, then we have really lived as a human being, as man. This preparation of the soil involves, of course, the right care of the body. Not in terms of vanity. Almost everybody who looks after the body does so out of some vanity or other. He wants to be a prize winner in sport or athletics or a record breaker and so forth. Or he or she wants to be perfectly handsome, beautiful, attractive, etc. And all those things, they are essentially right in themselves as such. But if the motivation behind is a vested interest, in order that oneself is going to gain something for oneself in competition or by comparison with another, then the whole effort is self-defeating and leads one into trouble invariably. So if we take the simple fact that the body needs right food, why do we take right food? In order that we may be healthy and strong. Why do we want to be healthy and strong? And the answer usually is in order to enjoy life and to succeed in life. Succeed meaning fulfill our particular vested interest, our particular desire or passion or pursuit or whatever it is. Now, if one recognizes that the body must have right food, I think the Buddha put it most succinctly, not for fun, not for beautification, etc. He uses several words like that, but in order to keep the body going so that it will not obstruct the living of the holy life, the treading of the path, the brahmacharya. Now, if that is the aspiration underlying it, then one is dealing with the body appropriately. And if one deals with the body that way, intelligently, and at the same time awakens to a true sense of self-awareness, which will include all other human beings also. You become aware of other human beings. You just don't look at them critically. You see the fact without judgments, either for or against the other body. You see, if one does that and you awaken to true self-awareness, then one will never sort of rant and rave against a person who does not eat red meat 5 times a day or live entirely upon orange juice and ice cream. One just naturally lets the right thing be done, and one can let the right thing be done only as and when this inner intelligence awakes. And that inner, and the awakening of that inner intelligence also means that compassion in the true sense functions naturally. You don't have to try to be compassionate or conflict with your own inner reactions in order to suppress conflict. You know how in Huineng definitely says, what is the sutra called?
Sutra of Huineng.
Mm. Pardon?
The Diamond Sutra.
No.
The Sutra of Huineng.
Mm. He says quite definitely that he who would tread the path is uncritical of others. Because compassion naturally awakes. So, as that happens, we begin to see the real trend of life in us and the purpose of our existence. To let these transcendent energies, or shall I say, these archetypal forms through which the primordial creative energy functions, let these archetypal forms flow freely through us, unobstructed. And the same applies to the psyche. The psyche has its own kind of food. The different cultural developments in the world and the specific abilities that characterize people. We are born with them. Some of us seem to have no ability whatever in some direction or other. But I think we, probably all of us, have some special ability. We have to let that come to flower. And for both of, and for, to let anything come to flower, there has to be this all-inclusiveness, this awareness which gathers everyone in. In the Gathas of Zarathustra, when he is asked, Zarathustra asks Ahura Mazda, which is the name for God in those scriptures, what are your names? And one of the names he gives is, I am the gatherer. I gather in everything and everybody. So you see, if transcendence itself does that, it is a beacon light to us also to be gatherers in that profound sense. It's not an easy task. It's a very difficult task. We all know that. But the great thing is to let it happen, not struggle for it. It will happen if we are quiet. You take a man who is, or a woman who has a genius for something or other, some art or some special ability. If that person grows in such a way that special ability comes to fruition, he hasn't to struggle in order to affirm it, because then one can make out that it is he who is expressing the limited self, the isolative self-consciousness at work, not the all-inclusive self-awareness. You look at a musician who performs and you say, oh, isn't he completely lost in his music? That's it. He is lost. But in his being lost, this self-consciousness is lost, and the inclusive awareness of everyone present is at work. And therefore there is this extraordinary happiness which is manifest when you listen to such a person or see some dancer who is capable of that sort of transcendent quality. The poet, when he produces truly great poetry, he is like that too. It's this inclusive self-awareness. So we can see that the trend of life in us is towards this utter purification of body and psyche, this preparation of the soil, and then that which is intended to be represented through man, the human being, does come to fruition and manifests itself quite naturally without him wanting to manifest it or show it. It has to be not a vested interest. And I think I'll have to stop there today. Thank you. Thank you.